Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. People often ask me if they're unsafe. No, they're not. They have a double push and twist mechanism which stops kids being able to turn it on and burn themselves. Push, push, turn. That's how it works. I love mine. It's a great gadget. Go to cooker.co.uk for more information and to look at the different models. This podcast is also sponsored by Unthin, a hair loss treatment. The treatment spray combines the most common treatments for reversing hair loss in the market. That's finasteride and minoxidil. I hope I'm saying those right. They both go to, well, actually the finasteride goes to reducing DHT, which is the main cause of male hair loss. And then the minoxidil, at the same time, re-energizes blood flow to hair follicles to encourage regrowth. There is no taking of pills. There's no pills being taken on my watch. No, there's no pills being taken. I am using it. And I think it's working. My friends have said they've noticed a difference. However, I'm still bored. do you know what? If you have any doubts, you know, people might just go, Lovejoy's a charlatan. I feel, just wait a little bit longer. I'm on TV every Sunday. Just watch me and you'll soon see whether it's working or not. But if you do want to give it a go, use the code LOVEJOY10 and get the first month for a tenner. Go to unthin.co.uk. Use the code LOVEJOY10. That's the number 10 for £10 for the first month. If you do use it, I think it takes about 3 months before it starts kicking in, 12 months before you get good growth back. And let me know how you're getting on so I can see if it's working on you too. Today's Lovejoy Hour, I'm back learning. Yes, I'm back looking at our diet. Today I'm curious about what the best diet is we can eat for maximum health. Returning to have a conversation about it is Dr. Megan Rossi, who's just written a new book called Eat More, Live Well. Enjoy your favourite food and boost your gut health with a diversity diet. As regular listeners will know, Dr. Megan is a dietitian and a nutritionist with an award-winning PhD in gut health. And she's a leading research fellow at King's College London. So she's proper. She's not one of those fancy Dan influencer type people. She's a proper, got all the qualifications and all that, ain't she? Let's meet her. Here's Megan. Hi, Megan. How are you?
Good. It's an absolute pleasure to be back here.
Yeah, great to speak to you again. Last time you came on, you made quite an impact. Loads of my mates went and bought your book. They loved the things you were saying. Just remind us, I've done a bit in the intro, remind us exactly what you do.
So I work as a research fellow at King's College in London, looking at all different types of nutrition interventions and essentially how they impact not just our gut health, but that connection with our brain health, with our heart health, with our mental, you know, well-being, all of the rest of it. It's such an incredible area, and I'm sure we'll go more into that. And then I also work at the gut health clinic, so actually working with clients one-on-one, which I think is really important to make sure my research, you know, keeps relevant.
Yeah, so on a day-to-day basis, someone comes in and sees you. You then try and look at their diet and then work out how they can live a better life or how they can get healthier.
Absolutely. And I guess it's not just their diet. We know that the lifestyle, you know, things like medication, their blood work, all of those sorts of things really give us the whole picture to see kind of what's going on. Now, I'm not sure if we'll get into it, but poop tests may be something that, you know, on people's minds. Do I recommend everyone go and get a poop test before they come and see me in clinic? And actually, the answer is no, not at the moment. And certainly in my research world, we do collect poop samples to get a better idea of what sorts of bacteria are living in people's guts. But actually, it's really not ready for that that translation yet. So those who come to me in clinic who've done the poop test through these commercial companies, you know, I say, look, this is interesting, but actually it's not going to change kind of my clinical recommendations at the moment. I think maybe in 5-10 years when the tests are kind of more robust and more valid, then perhaps. But at the moment, I'd say save your money, spend it on good food, getting a massage, and all the other things we know can actually help with your gut health.
Yeah, I think one of the big problems we've got at the moment is it's quite a new field, isn't it, really? Bizarrely, the stuff we eat is quite in its infancy, and there's a lot of people out there telling us they know the answers. And you know, I feel like every time I pick up a magazine or I go online or I look at something, there's somebody telling me what I should be eating, how I should be doing it, the way I test myself. And I know we discussed this last time, but I'm not sure they're charlatans, but there's a lot of those people out there giving probably poor advice, aren't they?
Yeah, look, I mean, that's the whole reason why I wrote the new book, Eat More, Live Well, because I wanted to, I guess, share the latest scientific evidence, but also the areas we don't know enough about. And I think this discovery that we contain these trillions of bacteria in our gut, we call this our gut microbiome collectively, it actually really has brought this whole new level of understanding to food and nutrition. So historically, certainly when I was studying nutrition and dietetics, you know, back a decade plus ago, we were taught that food had an impact on our health, and that was via human metabolism, the way that human cells digested, you know, food. But now we appreciate there's this whole new pathway, and that's how this food is digested and feeds the gut bacteria. Because the science is showing that these gut bacteria living within us are capable of thousands of different functions, you know, impacting things like our metabolism, you know, impacting things like our cell turnover in our skin and so many other things. So it's this discovery of actually how we can nourish these bacteria through our diet that I think is the missing link for us to appreciate more around how important and how mechanistically we can really maximize our health through nutrition.
I suppose you have to be careful here, but we get lots of chefs coming on our Sunday brunch at the moment. And again, we have to keep giving warnings because they come on and they say things like turmeric, it'll cure, I don't know, something or other. And it's like, just add black pepper to turmeric and it will cure you. And we're going, hold on a second, whoa, you know, you can't make those sorts of claims. But there's a lot of people doing that sort of thing at the moment where they're saying, because food we know is so important to our overall health, but there isn't these, is it, or magic ingredients which are going to like cure disease? It's not really like that, is it?
No, in fact, we're actually finding it's nearly the opposite of having a superfood. What the science is highlighting is that each different type of plant contains different plant chemicals which feed our body, but also our gut bacteria in different ways. And if we just kind of fixated on whatever the superfood of the month was and ate just that, actually we would really reduce down the bacteria in our gut. And in turn, we would reduce down the skills and the things these bacteria could actually do for us. So the science is showing actually people who eat more different types of foods, so really diversifying their plant-based foods, actually seem to have better not just gut health, but overall health compared to those who kind of focus on just a core number. And that's one of, you know, the key reasons why we're seeing things like, you know, veganism actually doesn't necessarily mean that you've got good gut health, even though you're having a lot of plants. We know plants feed your gut bacteria, because actually people who go on a vegan diet, you know, there's many different ways of doing it. Some people actually eat the same foods on repeat. Some people have these ultra processed foods. And seeing that, we actually identify that actually they're not really nourishing the right bacteria and they're not getting that diverse range. Now, I completely understand why a lot of people, you know, do make outlandish claims like around turmeric, and they get really excited about certain things. But that's when, you know, I think we always need to bring it back to the science, boringly. But, you know, ask ourselves, have there been a human study which has shown a benefit for that particular, you know, ingredient or supplement? And actually, in most scenarios, the research is done in animals. And, you know, less than half of the animal studies actually translate into human studies. And those that do translate, actually about a quarter of them actually show similar results. Another quarter, about 20% of the studies have in animals, when they translate to humans, actually have the opposite effect. So we need to be really careful about where we kind of extrapolate these research studies from. And yeah, asking, has there been a human study showing these benefits, is kind of the safeguard I recommend that people ask before they kind of deviate on down these kind of, you know, supplement routes, or even like these fad diets out there, like the keto diet. Don't even get me started on the keto diet. That actually does damage to our gut bacteria, and we think that's probably one of the reasons why that actually, you know, people who go on the keto diet, once they start to reintroduce, you know, things like legumes and grains and things like that, actually they start to experience a significant increase in their weight, much more than what they lost. And that's because if we do damage to the gut, our gut is really, really important for our metabolism. So things like regulating our appetite hormones and fat distribution throughout the body. So if we damage the gut, we think that that might be one of the rebound effects of these sorts of fad diets.
Okay, I've got to pick up on a couple of things there. First of all, the keto diet. I was listening to a podcast recently where some form of doctor or scientist who was saying it's actually really quite hard to get your body into ketosis and stay in it. If you manage to do it for a long periods of time, it's pretty an incredible thing because your body doesn't like being in it. Is that correct?
That is correct. You actually need to be testing your blood ketone levels like every day throughout the day to make sure you're in ketosis, that state of having a lot of ketones in the body instead of having the glucose, which our body prefers to use as energy. But if it can't access it, then it will use those ketones.
So the theory behind the keto diet is you're using a different source of energy, which means you're always burning your fat.
Exactly. And actually what we see is that produces a lot of chemicals which actually can suppress the appetite. So you don't feel very well. You also have like a stinky breath. You're more likely to get constipated. There's all of these other side effects of it that, you know, I hear from my clients who go on it, go, oh my God, it's just not worth it. And like I'm sure people who are listening to us who may have tried it will appreciate, very few people can stand it for a long period of time. And when people come off it, like I said, they not only gain that weight they may have lost, but actually extra because of the potential damage that it's done to their metabolism.
Right. So you say you damage your gut. Are you talking? So when you talk about your gut, it's this weird thing now that we realize that our gut is not so much our tissues. It is a bit of that and a bit of the enzymes we're creating, but a lot of it is the bacteria, and that's now qualified as us, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we talk about, you know, our gut health, it actually relates to that 9-meter digestive tract. So the tube that delivers food from entry all the way to exit. And like you were saying, along that 9 meters, we have these trillions of microorganisms, the bacteria. But actually, Tim, you probably already know this, but the listeners might, we actually contain things like viruses and parasites and fungi such as yeast, which actually work together with the bacteria. So although in today's day and age, we've, I guess, you know, learnt to be scared of the word virus because obviously things like COVID-19, but actually the vast majority, you know, are really beneficial and they want us to survive because they live within us. So, you know, they are working to look after us, but in turn we have to look after them to maximize what they can do for us.
Yeah, I suppose we get into that whole thing of what actually are we? Because obviously there's a consciousness somewhere, but we are obviously our skin, our bones, everything else, but we're also our parasites, our virus, our bacteria. We're a whole ecosystem. We're a whole little universe, aren't we, basically? I think that's the way to look at it.
Yeah, no, we honestly are. We couldn't survive without, you know, these trillions of organisms within us. They do so many, you know, mechanisms in the body that we thought human cells did, and now we appreciate actually, yeah, that's the microbes doing their job.
So the bit I don't get, and we're going to get onto this because you talk about it in your book as well, is there's a connection between the gut and the brain. Now, obviously, loads of people have always said, oh, your second brain is in your gut and all that sort of stuff. But there's a belief that the gut is actually communicating with your brain now. Is it? I mean, I can't quite work out how that happens and how it's doing that.
Yeah, so like you said, Tim, we've known, you know, for a long period of time that our gut and brain are connected, and that's essentially why, you know, it was historically called the second brain. So we have, you know, 100 million nerve system kind of innervating the gut, connecting the brain to the gut, and that's called our enteric nervous system. But there more recently has been this key player that we've discovered, and of course that is our gut microbes. So our gut microbes are thought to communicate to our brain via 3 key mechanisms because, you know, they're in very different parts of the body. So I understand why people are like, oh, this sounds a bit woohoo. But there's 3 ways. One is via the immune system. So 70% of our immune system lives in the gut. alongside our bacteria. So the bacteria sense something's going on. They activate our immune system that releases inflammatory chemicals, which then go and activate our brain and say, look, something's going on. So that's like an alarm system. That's the first route of communication. The second one is via like this mobile phone. So some people may have heard of the word of vagus nerve that zips up via the gut to the brain. So the bacteria can actually activate that mobile phone that zips up via the vagus nerve and tells our brain, look, something's going on. So that's a mobile system. And the third one is a good old postal service, where the bacteria actually produce chemicals, you know, via the digestion of some of our food. They release these chemicals, they get into our blood, and some of them can actually pass that blood-brain barrier. So that's the postal service. So you've got the alarm system, the mobile phone, and the postal service. There's the three mechanisms of how, you know, these organs and very different parts of the body can communicate.
And what are they saying?
A lot of things. So, you know, they can do things like tell us when we're hungry. They can augment our appetite hormones. Some of the research is showing it can affect things like, you know, the happiness hormones that are being produced in our brain. Now, although, you know, people may have heard serotonin is produced in the gut, it absolutely is. So that's one of the happy hormones. Actually, that serotonin in the gut can't pass that blood-brain barrier. But we are seeing that the bacteria in the gut are thought to tap into some of the chemical productions in the brain that can affect our mental health. In fact, there is, you know, an amazing study. It's my favorite study still to this date, even though it was published back in 2017, called the SMILES trial. Perhaps I spoke about it last time, Tim, but essentially it was the first landmark study to show that following a gut-boosting diet with plenty of varied plants, not plants only, and I think that's one of the key principles I talk about in the book. You don't have to go plants only, but as long as the base of your diet is plants, they showed following this diet for 12 weeks had a significant improvement in people's mental health, and they actually clinically measured that. And in, I think it was about 32% of the participants had a significant improvement in their depression scores, which would have classified them as no longer clinically depressed. So that diet was undertaken in people who had, you know, a moderate to severe depression that was medically supported. So, you know, there is now really strong evidence to highlight that nourishing these bacteria can improve things like our mental health.
Is our diet in the West, is it killing us, do you think?
That's a strong one.
Is it making us ill?
Yeah. Well, we know that our lifespan is actually increasing, but actually that the happy, you know, medication-free years is actually decreasing. So I am a firm believer that the sorts of things we are eating certainly is increasing our risk of all of these morbidities. So things like, you know, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, mental health diseases, all of those sorts of things. So absolutely, I think our diet has a huge part to play.
I've never been to Australia, and that's where you're from, right? But as I understand it, the Australian diet is fantastic because it's had so many influences from all over Asia and everywhere else, and it's very diverse, lots of healthy food. When you come over here, I've never been there, so I don't know. I might be talking rubbish there. You might just eat pie and chips every day over there, but that's not what I've heard. But when you come over here, there does seem to be maybe us in America... we do seem to have a slight problem with vegetables, trying to encourage people to eat vegetables. Do you find that in your clinics? Is there a slight British problem with vegetables?
Yeah, well, just unfortunately in Australia, you know, there is a perception that we're all, you know, into having whole foods and things like that. But unfortunately, the average person is not consuming, you know, enough veg. But yeah, no, absolutely. I think in particular in the UK, there does seem to be this kind of negative approach to veg. And I'm not sure whether that's, you know, the government's public health messages kind of being portrayed in a negative light and not really penetrating through. But, you know, one of the key things that I really am passionate and it comes through hopefully in the book, that people start to appreciate that, you know, when I talk about plants, it's not just veg, and I'll touch on veg in terms of, you know, the flavor and things like that. But we actually have these six different plant-based food groups, and the science is showing it's really important that we include all six, which is why the, you know, go for five a day campaign is actually outdated, because it doesn't take into account the needs of our gut bacteria, which actually requires the different plant chemicals from all six plant-based food groups. So you got your whole grains, your nuts and seeds, your fruit, your veg, your legumes, your beans, your pulses, and your herbs and your spices. And they all deliver different things. So we can't just get all our fiber from fruit or all our fiber from veg, because there's, you know, close to 100 different types of fiber, and they all are, you know, supporting our bodies in the different ways. Now, you know, for those who are listening and go, okay, yeah, I get that I need to eat more plants, but you know what? I just don't like them. And I actually have a case study in the book, Tim, you might be finding that there, because so many people that I see in clinic, including my husband, he was a massive meat eater. So, you know, I completely understand where people are coming from. Now, the first thing to keep in mind is that anything can taste bad if it's not cooked right. Now, there is a world of difference between soggy boiled Brussels sprouts and, you know, this Brussels sprout super pesto that I've got in the book. And, you know, I love, you know, giving this recipe to people who say that they don't like a Brussels sprouts to me. Because I'm like, you taste this. And I obviously do it blinded. So I don't tell them what they're having. I'm like, oh, this is delicious. And then I let them know, hey, that actually has Brussels sprouts in it. So it's about just working with some of, you know, the key flavors. And, you know, other recipes is like the cashew cheese. It takes like 5 minutes to make, but really does lift the flavor of veg.
All right, let's talk about the book. What's interesting about your book is I think it was October time, maybe November, end of October, beginning of November, I decided to try and do plant-based just to know what everyone's talking about. I thought, because so many people come on my show and they talk about it, and so many of my friends were doing it, and all, you know, the whole of the celebrity world are doing it. But I'm not a vegan and I'm not plant-based. I want to state that, but I thought I would try the diet. So I've gone into it and just trying to like only just avoid meat, fish, dairy and all that sort of stuff. And I must say, the first thing that I want to say, and actually you talk about this in your book, all the food aimed at vegans and plant-based, sausages, burgers, things like that, it's disgusting because it tastes of chemicals. That stuff, I'm sorry, it's got to be worse for you than a sausage. It is just, you taste it and you're like, I'm just tasting like weird chemical stuff here. Yet vegetables, I love vegetables anyway, but I'm seeing them in a new light, and I'll get into that. But you mentioned that crap that's being made for the plant-based community or the vegan community. It's a lot of it is processed rubbish, isn't it?
Yeah, look, Tim, I mean, it is a bit of a concern that a lot of people, you know, have this association that, you know, these vegan foods or plant-based automatically means healthy. So, you know, these sausage rolls, these, you know, these pies and things like that. And when you look at what's actually in them, like you're highlighting, a lot of them contain these additives. And actually my research team at King's is currently looking at a specific category of food additives, because some of the, you know, initial pilot studies are suggesting some of them actually might be damaging for the gut. So, you know, there is about 400 different food additives which have been approved as safe for humans to consume. But all of that research had been done before we understood about the importance of our gut bacteria. So the European Food Safety Authority is actually recommending that we go back and retest all of these food additives and looking at how they're impacting our gut. So one of the key messages that I want, you know, people to understand is that, you know, the research isn't there for me to say don't have, you know, food additives. They're really dangerous, because the research isn't there. But it is worth keeping in mind that actually adding all these things into your diet might not actually be achieving the goal that you're after in terms of, you know, better health overall. So, hey, why don't you try and make, you know, the veggie burger? It takes 15 minutes to make. You make them in bulk, freeze them so you've got individual portions. Not only are they likely better for you, but they taste a lot better as well and are much cheaper. So it's about just thinking about trying to make your own where you can.
So I think I'll talk about the bad stuff before I talk about the good stuff. And by the way, I've had a positive experience with it. And I reiterate, I haven't gone plant-based. I'm still eating meat, and I eat it on Sundays on the show, and which is what your book is about. It's about not cutting everything out. It's about just really increasing the level of vegetables. So, you know, it's really chiming with me, because it's what I sort of started to do. But the one thing, and I'm going to be blunt with it, is when you start eating a lot of vegetables and so chickpeas, lentils, things like that, which I was doing to get my protein in, you end up getting wind. I'm really sorry, but it's just, it is true. And you kind of feel a bit, sometimes with some of them, you can feel a bit bloated. I'm not actually feeling very bloated now, but sometimes in some meals you go, wow, that's and you don't get that on a sort of, you know, meat and two veg diet. So yeah, that is a negative side to it. In the book, you say it settles down. Is this your experience?
Yeah, so that's why in the book I actually have a sensitive gut menu plan, you know, because a lot of people, they experience these side effects and they go, oh, that's enough. Plants don't agree with me. I'm out. So it's about helping people to adjust to eating more plants. Remember, not necessarily plants only, without getting some of those side effects. But I think it's important that we discuss, I guess, why these happen and where they come from. So when we eat plants, one of the key things that they contain is dietary fiber. Now, the thing about dietary fiber is that human cells don't have the enzymes to break down fiber. So actually, fiber goes undigested through most of our 9-meter digestive tract, and then it gets to the last about 1.5 meters. And that is where we contain most of our gut bacteria. And it's the bacteria that have the specific enzymes needed to break down that fiber. So essentially, that's why fiber feeds our gut bacteria. You know, they're the only ones that can digest it. But when they digest it, they naturally produce a little bit of gas. And it's completely inert. They produce a range of other chemicals, these things like short-chain fatty acids, which are things like help strengthen our gut lining, communicate with our brain, regulate appetite, all of that sort of stuff. So it's really beneficial, but they do produce a little bit of gas. Now, if you go from very little fiber to having loads of fiber, your bacteria get a bit excited and they have this massive party. They kind of binge on the fiber and they release a lot more gas. And when they release the gas, what that does is stretch out your intestine that little bit, and that can trigger the bloating. And then in some people who've got a sensitive gut to start with, that can create a little bit of cramping as well. So one of the things that I talk about in the book is ways to reduce down those sorts of symptoms by going easy on your gut. And for those who already have quite a sensitive gut, that's where the sensitive gut menu plan comes into play, because what it's done is reduce down the sorts of fiber that produce extra gas. So you still get enough fiber following that menu plan, but actually it's cut down the ones which are more gas forming, so to speak. And the
What are those ingredients which are more gas forming?
Yeah, the more gas forming ones are called these FODMAPs. Have you heard of a FODMAP diet before? A low FODMAP diet? So it's a diet that people who have irritable bowel syndrome may have heard about. It's a medical diet that we know absolutely can help in the short term, help people get on top of their irritable bowel syndrome. However, what we know is actually that should only be done, you know, with the support of a FODMAP trained dietitian, and it's a three-step process. So you go through and you cut it down, so you restrict it, and then you go through this phase of just for 4 to 6 weeks of a low FODMAP diet. But then it's really important you go through the second stage of reintroducing. And then the third stage is personalization. Now, I talk about all of that in my first book, Eat Yourself Healthy. And instead of, because I understand that not everyone has access to a dietitian, I've created this FODMAP light approach. So what it does is not a very intense strict FODMAP diet, because we know in the long term that can be quite damaging for the gut if it's not done correctly, but it just takes out some of the higher food. So Tim, you're probably searching through the book, and it actually has at the back of the book a page where it highlights the foods that are high in FODMAP and those that are low in FODMAP. So we know the higher FODMAP foods are things like your legumes, things like your garlic and your onion and your Brussels sprouts and those sorts of foods, things like pistachio nuts also higher. So what I have done with that menu plan is just with those ones in particular, just reduce down the portions. Now, it's important that people don't just cut these foods out and go, oh, they don't agree with me. Because like I was highlighting, Tim, and you found in yourself, is that actually your gut does adjust to them, but you just need to go slow and steady. So it's a case for those who've got a really sensitive gut, it's things like, you know, starting out with literally triple rinsing your legumes to start with, because that helps reduce some of the gas forming chemicals. But then literally having like, you know, a tablespoon of legumes every day with your lunch. Second week, you build up to 2 tablespoons. Third week, 3 tablespoons. And you'll notice your gut actually adapts to them, and you won't get any symptoms in doing that kind of slow, steady approach, because your gut bacteria become more efficient at digesting that gas that they've produced, and also a lot more is absorbed into your gut, into your blood, and then you actually breathe that gas that's produced out instead of it kind of getting trapped in your gut or coming out your back end as wind.
Yeah. So you've done, this book's great, by the way, because I love it. It's like you've done switches. So if you to switching garlic to garlic infused olive oil and onion to chives or green path spring onions, things like that. So there's some good ways of changing the diet there. I think one of the good things that's happened with my doing this plant-based type, most of my meals now are plant-based at the moment. As I keep telling everyone, I'm just trialing it to see how I think. But I think my skin looks better. I think my skin feels like more collagen-y, but I might just be making that up. And I also think I'm making up the word collagen, whatever that word is. But what do plants actually do for you? Why should we be thinking about more plants?
Yeah, Tim, I mean, it there definitely is actually science behind your observation that you're finding. And I talk more about this gut-skin connection in the book where, you know, we not only have the trillions of bacteria in our gut, but we actually have billions of bacteria on our skin. They actually act like a second skin. And we call this our skin microbiome. And the science around our skin microbiome is absolutely fascinating in terms of things like skin aging. But the research has shown that people who include more plants in their diet, actually, it has helped with the appearance of skin aging. And that was, you know, a clinical trial, which was very exciting. So one of the things I joke about in the book is like, do you want Botox or just, hey, why don't you add some more plants in your diet? And I certainly hear it all the time in clinic as well. You know, one of the extra benefits of including, you know, more different plants in the diet is the potential benefits on your skin health too.
You can see me on the video. I think my skin's looking quite shiny. It's something I just noticed. It could be absolute nonsense as well though. So I'll see how that gets on. Why is it that we crave carbs so much then? Why is it, as humans, we see a plate of chips or some, I don't know, sourdough bread or something, and or mashed potato, roast potatoes, we just like, oh, we want to eat that. That is what we want to eat.
Yeah, you know, Tim, one of the things that the additional things we're talking about, the people who don't like plants, we said, you know, it's about how you present plants. Anything can taste bad. The other thing is actually our taste buds regenerate every 10 or so days. And what the studies have actually shown is if you start to include more plants, then actually you start to crave and enjoy those types of plants more so. And actually your taste receptors in terms of the sweetness level becomes more sensitive. And then you get kind of that, if you have some sweets, you get that buzz on less amount of, you know, the added sugar. And even the interesting part about all of this is not only the taste buds regenerating, but the bacteria in our mouth are thought to be key in that changing, because they change along with our diet. And that's thought to change some of that chemical taste perception. So it's really fascinating stuff around how, you know, the taste buds are changing, and that really comes into the potatoes and the carbs and the breads and things like that, where, you know, people who follow this very varied diet, yes, they'll still enjoy potatoes and bread and stuff, but actually it's not, you know, the only thing that they get a buzz about. Actually, the more different types you include, the more you start to teach your taste buds that they get, you know, a buzz out of things like, you know, Brazil nuts or things like tofu that they never thought that they would like. And one of the references in the book, you know, he's like, oh, this is like magic. My taste buds are just changing. But no, it's actually based on the science. And that's another, you know, reason with the diversity diet, which I talk about, it's focusing on more about what you're adding in and not necessarily cutting out, because the people I see in clinic who probably put things like carbs, so the potatoes and the bread, up on a pedestal have been the ones who've been on restrictive diets and who have been told that they're off limits, because that has this psychological effect on our relationship with that food. And I don't know about you, as soon as someone says I can't eat something, you know, maybe I cannot eat it for a couple of weeks, then after a while I start to think nothing of it. And that's just the way that our brain is typically wired. So, you know, if we start to have, you know, a more healthy relationship with food, and if Tim, you feel like you're out of control with any sort of carb, then I have an exercise in the book called a mindful eating exercise that I've been using with, you know, so many of my clients for a very long time, where they get their, you know, favorite food or the food they feel out of control with. They do this exercise twice a week. And after about 8 or 9 weeks, they start to notice that actually they feel really satisfied, you know, for example, with chocolate, with just one square. You know, they come from a place where they've said, I can't have any chocolate in my house because I've just binge on it. But actually re-engaging all six senses with that food, you know, over time, you can rebuild that relationship with food. So if you're faced with potatoes or, you know, delicious extra virgin olive oil and, you know, sourdough, you're not going to just binge on it. You're going to enjoy some, but hey, you want something different because your palate also is kind of asking for that.
Yeah, I there's a case study in your book about a guy who does fast food all the time because of his work schedule, and then you change his diet and then he starts eating fast food and he doesn't like the taste of it anymore. And I must say, I do dislike saying this because I want to be a man of the people, but I haven't eaten fast food in such a long time because doing the show, you just find it so easy to make food after doing Sunday brunch that I'd rather make my own food at home. And every time I do end up having a McDonald's or something, it's a bit like, oh my God, this is so sweet. And it's like, but that's the thing about that vegan food, like bacon. If you ever tried that stuff, it's like you're eating a sweet. It's like someone's put a sweet in the middle of your food because it's so sickly and horrible. I mean, all that stuff, I know, but again, you know, I know people out there absolutely adore it, but I don't think it takes a long time before your taste buds change to and I'm finding this with the vegetable thing, by the way, is that I'm getting more flavor out of the vegetable since that's the major concern on my plate is the vegetable rather than the meat. I'm now looking at more of the flavors and that, I don't know, I'm really enjoying it. By the way, I tried your bacon last night because I thought I should give one of your recipes a go before I did it. So I did the mushrooms in bacon in miso and Worcester sauce.
How'd it go down?
Yeah, delicious. Really lovely. Really, really nice, actually. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think the key, I have to say this, the key to, is to, you talk about taste buds there. Like Simon Rimmer taught me this on Sunday Brunch. You've got to try and tickle the taste buds, tantalize them. So people like tomato ketchup. In tomato ketchup, there's vinegar, there's salt, there's acidity, basically, there's salt and there's sugar. And it tickles taste buds. That's why you like it. So when you're using, when you're doing cooking vegetables, here you go. Look, I'm giving expert advice on cooking vegetables here. But like you did with the Worcester sauce and the miso, you're getting exciting flavors to tickle the tongue. I've just literally had a roasted, another pushback people say is expensive. I've just had roasted aubergine on toast for lunch. I roasted it last night. I've just had it cold. And basically, an aubergine costs under £1 and bread costs nothing. So, I mean, it's one of the cheapest meals you'll have. It's absolutely delicious. But I just dressed it. Can't believe I'm having this conversation. But chili flakes, oil, lemon, sumac, capers just on top of it. And it just tickles the taste, but it's the most exciting meal you can have. Whereas normally, up until last October, I'd have had a tuna salad every day or a tuna sandwich or, you know, something like that. So it's, you know, it's just getting the flavors right, isn't it?
It honestly is, Tim. And, you know, for those who've come from a place that they're like, well, I don't know how to, you know, do anything with plants, it is all about experimenting, like adding a few flavors here and there, tasting it. You know, you can't really go wrong, because I feel like, you know, my husband in particular, he was a massive meat eater and, you know, is now coming around and loves plants. When he initially started to cook with more plants, he was a bit like, oh God, I don't know how to make it taste good. So it's about, yeah, working with simple flavors. And I've got, you know, diagrams in the book where it's working with the key flavors that match the legumes, that match the whole grains, that match, you know, the green leafies. Because it, once you get the flavors right, you know, it's something that you can make in 5 minutes to get that right flavor to add to that veg.
Yeah, and don't tell the TV chefs this or the supermarkets, but I mean, cooking is not that complicated, and the sauces are not that complicated. It's just you get in and you mix it all together and put it on the food. Now, to cook to a high level, I mean, in fairness, everything Simon Rimmer cooks on Sunday brunch is absolutely delicious. But to get to a level of, you know, one of the Michelin star guys and something, yeah, that takes hard work, and you know, they've spent a long time getting those flavors. But to cook basic home food, it's just not that complicated to get a lovely load of vegetables together and to sort of marinate them or do something. And, you know, you've got plenty of examples in your book. I'm gonna try some of these, definitely going to try some, because you've got quite a lot in there.
It's like, you know, spending maybe an extra 20 minutes just once a week thinking through, okay, you know, what might I make this week? Just checking a few, you know, of the key ingredients that you've got. And that's about it. Like, I think there is this misconception that if you're adding more plants in, you're going to have to spend hours in the kitchen and hours prepping and going to all these fancy health food stores. You know, all the recipes that, you know, in the book, you can get from your, you know, your mainstream supermarkets. You don't have to spend extra. And as you found, Tim, in most cases, actually, it's cheaper to add more plants in. You know, tin lentils, it's like, you know, 60p. And if you're having a bolognese, why don't you cut out a third of the mince and add one of those cans in? It's an easy win.
Yeah, that is true. A lot of the food is very cheap. I mean, you've got six principles to the diversity diet. I suppose we haven't talked about diversity yet. My only concern with diversity is when people say diversity, obviously it's a word that's used a lot these days, but you imagine foods from all over the world. And I wonder if we need to be eating as many avocados as we're eating, or as many, you know, like flying stuff from South America over here constantly. I wonder if we, you know, can diversity not mean British veg, you know, as many different types of British veg you can get your hands on?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I'm all about buying in season and buying locally, not only for, I guess, the nutrition quality of it. We know that in season is going to be much better for you, but also, you know, in the environment, we need to nourish the environment, because actually we get a lot of our bacteria from the environment as well. So, you know, it works in cycles. So absolutely, you don't need to be getting all these fancy, like, you know, exotic fruit flown in from all these different countries. Absolutely, I'm not about that. It's just about thinking, hey, you know what, I have an apple every day. Why don't I try get, you know, some frozen berries in there? Or why don't, you know, I mix up and get a pear? Or what else is in season? So I've got like these seasonal charts and things like that. So yeah, no, I'm definitely all about buying locally as well.
I was horrified to find out that apples I buy from supermarkets were picked 6 or 7 months ago, or, you know, even further than that, and they just take the air out of them. I'm like, really? What? Why are we eating that crap? But I suppose we don't have a choice.
Yeah, but also, you know, the farmers are now encouraged to grow just the very sweet tasting apples, because the way our taste buds have all changed. And the science has shown that actually the kind of the older types of apples, the older, you know, the cultured ones. Yeah, so the science has actually shown that now the types of species of apples that we're getting are much sweeter. And what we're finding, they contain less of these beneficial plant chemicals, which we call polyphenols, compared to the types and the varieties of apples we used to eat 100 years ago. So, you know, there's so much happening in the food industry that we need to be more cautious about.
Okay, let me ask you a quick question, because everyone looks at me weirdly when I do it, but I eat the whole apple. I just eat from the bottom all the way through, because I just, you know, I do it through pure laziness. When I was a kid and I used to eat apples, my mum never had a bin in the front room or anything, so I had to take my core out and I couldn't be bothered, so I just ate it. And I've just got used to doing it. It just tastes like an apple to me. All of it just tastes like an apple, just slightly different textures. And everyone still looks at me weirdly, and I keep going to them, no, I think the core is the best bit. We should be eating the core. That's where all the gubbins is of the apple. I think that's the bit you need to eat. Am I right or wrong?
You're right. I do the exact same thing. Everyone looks at me like I'm crazy, but actually we know that the apple not only contains like 300 different types of plant chemicals, some of which are in the core, but also that they contain, you know, millions of bacteria. Again, a lot of them are within the core. Now, we don't want to eat loads of apple seeds, but have, you know, if you have one or two, it's completely fine. But the core absolutely is worth it. That's really good nutrition to get in there.
There you go. I feel I'm gonna dig this bit out and take it around with me and keep playing it to all my mates who look at me as I'm mental. All right, let's talk about a few other things as well. Meal replacement drinks, they're becoming bigger. I'm getting served them constantly on the internet. I'm desperate to give it a go, because I kind of like the idea of one day having one meal a day, which is just a drink, and getting all my nutrition for the day via that drink. But I'm not sure whether they're there yet or not. What do you think? What is your how do you feel about these meal replacement drinks?
Look, if only. I mean, I get it. Life gets busy. Sometimes you think, God, imagine if I didn't have to shop, I didn't have to cook, it was just ready to go. And I actually talk about a client in the book who, you know, thought that exact same thing. He's like, I'm going to save all this time. So he started going on them. And this is just one example of, you know, probably close to 100 clients that I've seen over the last couple of years who've done similar things. And, you know, he's done it for a couple of months and actually just started to feel really fatigued and was like, oh, I don't know what's happening. Had all these blood work done and all came back like it was healthy. It was normal. He's like, gosh, what's going on? And he came to see me in clinic and, you know, I reviewed his shake diet and, you know, it made sense. So in these shakes, they contain all of the, what we call essential nutrients. There's like, you know, 20 plus essential nutrients, you know, micronutrients, vitamins, minerals, you know, a type of fiber that we need to survive. But we know that plants contain tens of thousands of other plant chemicals that are really important. So, for example, the humble apple, as I mentioned, contains like the 300 different types of plant chemicals. You know, one of them, you know, melatonin. One of them is inositol. Like all of these ones, dopamine even, one of the other feel-good hormones. You know, inositol has been shown to help with, you know, polycystic ovary syndrome. There are all these other chemicals that Mother Nature has hanging over us because we don't know how to put them into supplements yet, nor do we know how to put them into these special shakes. And like I said, these shakes often have one or two types of dietary fiber, yet we know that there's close to 100 different types of fiber. So there is a world of difference between surviving, i.e. having these, you know, 20 plus nutrients that we know we need versus, you know, the tens of thousands of other chemicals which help us thrive. So surviving versus thriving. So unfortunately, that is the reason why we can't just, you know, be at our optimum by having these shakes. We're not going to feel great. And I'm yet to meet anyone who after a couple of weeks still feels like they're going well. Fatigue really sets in.
I'm surprised the companies which make these aren't on your case to try and get you to people like you to try and help make them so that they...
Oh, of course they have. No, they have. And I've just had to go back to them and be like, sorry, you know, unless you can make these, you know, 10,000 chemicals and put them in the drink, I can't make people unwell by having, you know, thinking they can have these drinks.
So what's interesting about it is you said saving time. That was not my process at all. That was not my thought process at all. What my thought process was is people like yourself and everywhere I look are telling me that I need a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of this and 2,000, you know, different chemicals from this and hundreds of there, da, 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 and all this bacteria. And I thought if a human can put it all in one drink so I don't have to worry about it, then that would be a good solution. So once a day I could go, I've done it all. Now everything else is my anything else I eat is a bonus. That's why I was thinking they could be good meal replacement drinks.
Yeah, but unfortunately not a lot of these plant chemicals, that we call them phytochemicals, they're plant chemicals, in the tens of thousands of them, a lot of them are processing sensitive. So whenever they are trying to be extracted, actually that denatures them and therefore they don't have that same, you know, chemical response in the body as when ingested in a whole food.
Okay, so your theory is to eat 30 different types of plants, which includes the six categories you mentioned earlier, a week. Is that right? Diversify as much as possible, eat 30 different types or different portions?
Different types. So this is based on a research study which looked at people who had at least 30 different types of plants in their diet per week had better gut health than those who ate the same 10 on repeat. And what they did is looked at those who were vegan versus omnivores, and actually omnivores, the ones who eat plants but also eat animals. And what they showed is that it didn't matter whether someone was a vegan or an omnivore, the key predictor of gut health was the plant diversity. So those who were getting in the different types. And it's just about, you know, changing our mindset at the shops. You know, instead of just getting the one type of veg, you know, get the stir fry mix with like five different types. Instead of just getting, you know, the one type of grain, get the pack that now has like five different types. So it doesn't have to cost anything extra, no extra time. It's just thinking the diversity wherever you can. And Tim, you may have come across the apple dissected in the book, that page, which shows those, you know, all the different types of chemicals just in an apple. And if you extrapolate that out to all of the different types of plants available to us, I think it starts, you know, change your mindset and you start to appreciate, oh, actually, this is why I need to diversify, because there's all of these other types of, you know, chemicals in these foods, which are going to do different things for my body, my mental health, you know, the skin health, as we touched on.
So there's a difference between being a vegan and being plant-based. Obviously, being a vegan, you cut out all animal products, and being plant-based, I think you're allowed dairy, are you? I think that's...
That's what I talk about in the book, is this kind of plant-based redefined. I think there is a lot of confusion around plant-based because it had been tagged onto the veganism. But actually, I guess the clue is in the name. So it's basing your diet on plants, plant-based, but not plants only. So the science is showing wherever you sit on this plant-based spectrum, whether at one end it's veganism, the other end it's flexitarianism. So flexitarianism, eat all animal products, but as long as the base of your diet, like, you know, 80% plus is plants, then whatever you choose to add on top of that is completely up to you, and it's not going to have a negative impact on your health.
So the big one is when you cut out animal products, especially meat, I think definitely red meat, is there's this ingredient which I have no idea what it does, but everyone talks about it, called B12, and that's what you become. I think there's other things as well, but you become deficient in B12, and that's often the case. Is that right? Have I got that right?
You have, and yeah, there's a few others if you are going 100% plant-based, going vegan. And actually, that's one of the reasons why I don't typically recommend, you know, everyone go vegan, is because actually you are at a slightly higher increased risk of becoming nutrition deficient. And the, you know, the scientific studies are highlighting for overall health, actually, you know, veganism doesn't mean you're any healthier. And yeah, like you highlighted, we know B12, which is really important for, you know, hundreds of different mechanisms in the body, including things like, you know, brain function, you know, liver function, you know, pancreas function, all of that sort of stuff. Omega-3s is another really big one. So we know we can get some types of shorter chain omega-3s from plant foods like chia seeds and tofu and walnuts. But actually the long chain omega-3s, so the EPA and DHA, which come from things like oily fish, they are really, really important for not only our gut health, but our brain health. And you can't, so some of the short chain, so the animal source of omega-3 can get converted to these longer chain ones in the body, but it's not very efficient. So actually for most of my clients who would go vegan, if they want to, I say you should definitely take an algae oil supplement to get in those long chain omega-3s, as well as your B12. And then things like choline, selenium, iron, calcium, all other nutrients, I really check their diet for, which again highlights that, yeah, going 100% plant-based doesn't, you know, there is some risk attached to that. You need to be quite savvy.
So how often would you have to, if you decided to go plant-based or vegan, and then you, plant-based, how often would you have to eat oily fish or meat to get those levels up? Is it sort of like once a month, once a week, or more than that?
So if you're not having oily fish twice a week, I would recommend that you would take an omega-3 supplement. And if you are, you know, consciously choosing not to have fish, then actually you can, for you know, animal cruelty reasons, you can get an algae oil, which actually has those, you know, long chain omega-3s, which is the only source of a plant that contains the right type of omega-3, essentially. Otherwise, just get your normal omega-3 supplements. In terms of your B12, everyone, interestingly, actually, our bacteria produce B12, which is why we see that in some parts of the world, actually, who are vegan, they don't need to supplement with B12 because their bacteria produces enough. But for some reason, the Western world, actually, very few people produce enough B12. So if you are going vegan, the recommendation is that you do take a B12 supplement every day. For those who are plant-based and just occasionally eating animal foods, as long as, you know, we get B12 from all different animal foods, it's not just red meat. As long as you are having some animal foods, you know, whether it's things like, you know, your fermented dairy, your fish, eggs, those sorts of things, then you're probably going to be getting enough B12. But you can always, you know, go to your GP and get a blood test, which will quickly tell you.
What do you think of supplements? Because it always strikes me with supplements that if you're supplementing something that you can eat from normal food, aren't you just better off to eat the normal food?
Yeah. I mean, all the studies show that getting those nutrients from whole foods results in much better outcomes than if you're supplementing. And that's because when you're supplementing, it doesn't take into account the food matrix. So we know that things like, iron from foods and things like that, it's better absorbed within a food matrix. So that's why it's thought to be linked with better health outcomes. And you know, same with all these antioxidant supplements. Again, when they're in the food whole matrix, actually that is protected when it goes through like the acidic part of the gut and things like that. So absolutely, it's best to get your nutrients from whole foods. But of course, appreciate for different reasons, you know, people can't achieve that. And that's where there is, you know, that role for the supplements.
Two more things. Very fashionable at the moment is fasting and intermittent fasting. Lots of people do it. Where do you stand on that? Good idea?
You know what? The evidence overall suggests it's such an individualized thing. There is no robust evidence in humans. There is evidence in animal studies, but actually, I think we touched on it before, very few animal studies actually translate into human studies. So in terms of the human studies, they show that there's an individualized, you know, response to the fasting world. I would say if you are choosing to fast, and, you know, a lot of my clients do like to go down that route, mostly for weight management, where they're reducing down their eating window. But you need to still make sure you're getting adequate amounts of your dietary fiber, your plant foods in there. Because some of the animal studies have shown that if we're starving our gut bacteria, not giving them enough plants, they start to eat away at our mucus lining along our gut and make our gut lining more permeable. So make things to get from our gut into our blood system more likely. So we get this kind of leaky gut. Again, it's just in the short term, but it is just a reminder that we're not only starving, you know, the human cells, we're also starving the gut bacteria. And they're not very good when they're not getting enough fiber.
Oh my God, we're eating ourselves from inside out. That's like
it's the mucus layer, so it's not the actual cell, human cells, rest assured.
It's so bizarre though, isn't it, that we've got, I was listening to a podcast the other day on ants, and it's so, you know, they now look at ants as not just, I think I've said this before on the podcast, not as individual ants, but you have to look at the whole, I was going to say hive, but that's bees, the whole ant group, troop, whatever they are, the ant hill, as one animal, because they can't survive without each other. And the males only live for a week. They're just there to impregnate. And it's like, this is what we've got going on in us. It's like, you know, it's not just Tim. It's Tim and, you know, how many thousand friends have I got living on me and in me? 2,000, 300,000?
No, you've got trillions of microbes. Trillions. Yeah, trillions. Much more than a few thousand. And
trillions,
you know what?
Are my mates.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it can be hard for people to wrap their head around this thing that, you know, they've got these microscopic organisms in their gut. But I think if there's any sort of, you know, silver lining or benefit of COVID-19, it's to highlight that these microscopic organisms can be hugely powerful. Now, thankfully, like I mentioned, most in our gut are definitely there to look after us and nourish us. But if you think about, you know, this one virus and how, you know, it's causing this pandemic, think about the power within us. And we see the research is so striking, you know, a gut dysbiosis, so an imbalance of these bacteria, has been linked with over 70 different chronic conditions. And, you know, the research is only growing stronger and stronger how, you know, these things isn't just about preventing and, you know, treating conditions, but also longevity, where people who, the sanitarians who live to 100 plus, have different microorganisms than those who die earlier.
Okay. Whenever I have these conversations, my whole thing is always like, I have such little control over my body. Like, I can close my eyes, I can't switch my hearing off, I can move my arm, but I don't know what's going on with my liver. You know, it's like there's most, I think 95% of my body is working without my knowledge of it at all. And it's just trying to stay alive, you know, and even my mind is wakes up every day and it's got a different idea of what life's about. Final thing, you talked about weight management there. I know you're not a fan of calorie counting, but when I did a podcast with James Smith, who's a PT, we discussed calorie counting. I'd never done it before in my life, but I think what's a really useful exercise, especially in something like this, is he said, you know, if you go to a fast food restaurant or a restaurant, say Wagamama's, and you actually just look at the calories of the food that you are actually eating. And this was the point he made, and I've adapted this now to actually just look at what the hell I'm eating. And I think it's important to see what you're eating, because he was saying a katsu curry's over 1,000 calories, whereas a ramen is 500. Why have the katsu when you can have the ramen? Why are you going for all those calories? And I started looking at things like deep fried squid. Oh my God, the calories involved in something like that. So even though I know calorie counting, one calorie doesn't equal another calorie, they're not all equal. It's quite interesting to see what, because I always assumed it was quite healthy because it's, you know, it's squid and it's just, I just lightly fried it. But the calories in that is a whole meal in just a small portion of that stuff. So I do think it's interesting to see what you're actually eating. And just to continue that on, when you eat vegetables and you start putting those in a calorie counter, there's no calories in these things. It's like they're great for you, but you know, you can have a lot of vegetables in comparison to carbs and meat.
So I love this calorie topic, because I absolutely do appreciate, you know, in some contexts where calorie, you know, investigation may have a role. And, you know, I talk about that in the book in terms of how to understand that. But we need to appreciate that actually a lot of the calorie information is not as accurate as we've been led to believe, particularly for whole foods. So for example, almonds actually provide our body with 30% less calories than what the label says. And that's because the way that we determine calories in the lab burns down that food, extracts all of the energy, which is very different to how our digestive system works. So actually, when we eat things like almonds, we malabsorb a lot of that energy. Some of it our bacteria will eat and turn it into beneficial things. The first reason why I'm not a big fan of calorie fixation is the fact that the information is not all that accurate. Also, kind of like you highlighted, Tim, is that it doesn't take into account things like the satiety effect. So there's been some really interesting studies where they've taken meals which are identical in terms of their calories according to the label, but one is ultra processed and one is using whole foods. And what they showed is that those who had the whole food version, when they're on that arm, actually they lost a significantly more amount of weight compared to those who were in the ultra processed food. And that comes down to things like there's this thermogenic effect of food. So actually when we eat food, it burns some energy, which is more when we eat whole foods, you know, it burns that little bit more energy. Things like the satiety effect, where actually these whole foods, because of the food matrix, actually makes us fuller for longer versus ultra processed foods. So I've seen a lot of people in my clinic who have fixated on calories and they've started to go, you know what, a banana and a Kit Kat contain the same number of calories. So, hey, I'm going the Kit Kat. and what they don't realize is this, the banana not only contains things like potassium for the heart, prebiotics for the bacteria, which also is impacting things like the metabolism, but also, you know, changes things like the appetite regulation, fat distribution, and all that sort of stuff. So I think it's a bit narrow-minded to just look at food in terms of calories, because it doesn't translate. And if we look at the human studies, people who follow calorie restricted diets in the long term actually, you know, can't maintain that weight and they end up adding more on, which may be another mechanism similar to the keto diet where people have, you know, changed their eating, had more of these processed foods because they're like, oh, look, less calories, let me do that. And in turn, starve some of their gut bacteria.
Megan, thank you so much for joining me today. I love the book. I really did enjoy reading it, and I've learned lots from it as well, which is good. And it's funny that it's come out at a time when I'm just experimenting to do it. But yeah, I think I'm going to carry on just filling my life with vegetables because I think it just makes meals more exciting and interesting, and you know, just to do all those sort of things. I don't know, I'm thoroughly enjoying doing it, but as I say, I haven't cut out meat, and I do sometimes feel a bit like a vampire when I see meat on other people's plates. If I'm eating something plant-based, I do look at it and think, oh my God, I'd love to eat that, but I do still eat it, so you know, it's fine. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's an absolute pleasure. And Tim, remember, food is there to be enjoyed. So we shouldn't be cutting out our favorite foods. It's about adding in extra plants on top of, you know, the things that we enjoy.
Yeah, no, I do see that in your book, how you do it, but I don't agree with you at all. Food is fuel. That's all it is. It's, just, it's there to fuel those little bacteria inside you to keep your universe going. Thank you so much.